Hello there. Welcome to the Maker Manager Money Podcast, a podcast about entrepreneurs, solopreneurs, founders, business owners, and business partnerships. From startups to stay-ups, to inspire entrepreneurs to keep going and future entrepreneurs to just start. Today's guest is David Doty, a remarkable entrepreneur and visionary in the food industry and the founder and CEO of Kensington Asset Management, KAM. Is that right? KAM.
That's great.
Okay. With an impressive journey that started in finance, David worked as an equity trader at JP Morgan and a project manager at Goldman Sachs before pivoting to law and business, earning his JD and MBA from BYU on a full scholarship, along with a CFA charter. Shifting from Wall Street to Main Street, David's passion for small businesses led him to purchase his first food-related business during business school. This marked the beginning of KAM, his venture to revolutionize Utah's food scene by acquiring, operating, and growing high-quality, hospitality-focused food concepts. David's strategy isn't just about rapid expansion. He's focused on sustainable growth, owning real estate, and creating a lasting culture in the food and beverage industry. His portfolio includes beloved establishments like Lehigh Bakery and Magleby's Restaurant. David resides in Lehigh, Utah with his wife, Danielle, and their five children. Welcome to the show, David.
Hey, thanks for having me. That intro seemed exhausting.
Well, you've done a lot of things, and I've been snooping around LinkedIn, reading a bunch of your posts on LinkedIn. So we just have, there's so much to talk about. I don't know where to begin exactly, but what I think we should start is just how you grew up and how you ended up on Wall Street.
I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and so very blue collar town. So it probably makes sense to say on my 16th birthday, my mom said to me, "All right, get out of the house. Time to get your first job." And I had no idea what to do. I had mowed some lawns and done things, but I went down the road and the first place I saw was a Denny's. And so I walked in, turned in an application, got a call back the next day, and I started washing dishes at 16 years old. And I think it was from there that I just started to get more comfortable in the food business. It wasn't too long. I washed dishes and I loved that camaraderie in that dish room with some other kids my age. And then they said, why don't you come up and be a host? And that lasted another few months. And then before you knew it, I was serving tables. And the only thing I didn't do in that restaurant was just work on the line there with the cooks. But I came to just love working with my peers, everyday people, and the vast variety of people that work in a restaurant, from 16-year-old kids to 65-year-old servers and everything in between. I just love that dynamic and the people that come in and out of the restaurant. So I did that through high school and just came to love the food business. And I guess I thought for a while when I went to college that was going to be the end of my food journey. It just turned out not to be that way. So went to college just right down the road at the University of Pittsburgh, studied math and finance, and was good at it, good enough to be the first person from our school to go to be a trader on Wall Street, but always just felt like a complete fish out of water. You know, my mom had a very poor upbringing, and mine was just lower middle class upbringing. Just always felt a little strange going into 277 Park Avenue or 383 Madison Avenue in New York City, just being with a different, I don't know, class of people. So as I've come back to Main Street, I've just felt so much more comfortable and in my element.
You did something remarkable, and that is you started running track in high school, right? Which to me is remarkable because you hadn't really done track before, and somehow, was it your junior year, you started running track?
This girl comes up to me, my first day of senior year, and says, you run pretty good, because I was on the basketball team and I was always just running laps around everybody. She said, "You should come out for cross country." And I said, "I don't even know what that is." But she said, "Just show up today at 3 o'clock at the track," or whatever. I showed up in my Tracy McGrady basketball shoes and they said, "We're going to do a time trial." And I was second in the entire high school. on my first day running in basketball shoes. And I think all of the high school kids, I work with hundreds of them now, and they're just trying to find their place. And I don't think I was too different when I was in high school, trying to figure out where you fit in, right? It's a very high school thing. Like, who am I? Where do I fit in? And I had finally found, like, oh my gosh, maybe I can run. Maybe this is something I'm good at. I scored 3 points on the JV team my sophomore year. And so basketball was just not my thing as much as I wanted to be like Kobe Bryant. But running was something I could do, and eventually parlayed that into walking onto a Division I cross country and track team after less than a year of running.
That's amazing. And what were some of your achievements when you were doing that?
I mean, by today's standards, especially around here in Utah, these kids are unbelievably fast. So my times weren't anything comparable with these kids are doing today. They seem to get faster and faster. I mean, I have a record at our high school for the mile. It wasn't very fast. It was in the 440s. But I think what my coaches saw in me was a lot of potential. And I think that's what a lot of people have seen in me, is either going to college is, this kid has some potential. There's something a little different. He's willing to commit 110% to getting the job done. So even though he's run for a year, this kid, you know, is going to come in and do it. Or when I was an intern at JP Morgan in college during my junior year, I didn't have the accolades of, you know, going to the Ivy League schools or have taken all these classes on financial engineering or things like that, but they knew I was going to come in and outwork every single person out there. So, you know, over the years running, you know, was able to get some really great times for me, nothing Olympic standard or anything, but it was, for me, just trying to be the best version of myself and being 110% all in. And I think that reflects in what we do now at our company.
And so what do you attribute, because you had a lot of academic success as well, so academic and sports success, what do you attribute your drive? Where did that come from?
So I have always just really appreciated and valued the people that give 100% to what they do. I think I saw that, to bring up what you mentioned earlier, my mom didn't have two nickels rubbed together growing up. They actually called her Poor Patty. She was so poor. She had a dirt floor in her house. But when she got an opportunity when she was 18 years old to start to be a sonographer, to, you know, to scan pregnant women with their babies, she got that chance and she ran with it as much as she could. Even so, she got pregnant while she was in school. And back then, you could not be in school if you were pregnant because of all the radiation or whatnot that they had. She found a way. She would wear 4 sweatshirts to cover it up so that she could stay, and she wasn't going to let anything stop her. But she went with only a high school education that she was selected by her peers from all across the country to be the chair of the entire sonographer governing body of the entire United States, picked over doctors with accolades, you know, multi-page CVs. Here's this poor Patty from Pittsburgh with just a simple high school diploma and a girl that worked her guts out and was elected as the head of the national body. And so I saw that in her, and you know, my favorite athlete growing up was Kobe Bryant, you know, that Mamba mentality, do whatever it takes, everything you can do to give yourself an edge to be better. I've always valued that. And so when it came to running, it didn't take me long to say, oh, if I'm good at this, I'm going to go all in, right? So I'm going to run in the morning before school. I'm going to run at night. I don't care if it's 5 degrees outside in Pittsburgh, I'm running. I don't care if there's a blizzard, I'm doing it. And so we've just been everything, financing college. You know, I petitioned the dean of the business school to take MBA level classes so that I could be competitive with the kids that were coming in from the other Ivy League schools, right? So I've seen that example from my mom, and it's other people I value that just said, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it the best I can in the first class way to say, I'm not going to leave anything on the table. Everything's getting laid out. And as I get older, it's still with me. I just get a lot tired a lot faster.
So it sounds like your mom and the Mamba mentality.
Yes. Yeah. We're shaped by some of these people, right, that come into our lives or that inspire us. And we take some of their, not just, it's not just always financial resources or direct time spent, but it's the example that a lot of people give to you and that that you can replicate. So I've just always come back to this notion of 110%. I loved at my BYU graduation from law school and MBA, Ryan Smith came in, you know, Qualtrics founder, and he gave this phenomenal commencement speech, and he just talked about 110% and being all in and what that's meant for him in Qualtrics. And I was like, he was speaking to thousands of people, but I felt like he was speaking directly to me because, you know, his example of grinding through the hard times and his story of how, you know, he had to just figure it out a lot of times. And that's especially true of us in business now. And everybody thinks we have the answer all the time, but anybody that's in it for too long knows that half the time we're just floating around trying to figure out and see what sticks and see what works. But it's really easy to quit sometimes. It could be really easy to quit, but it's when you persevere and get through the hard running days, the hard days in college, sleeping 10 hours in a week to get a project done, or you know, doing 6 days a week at 1 a.m. learning how to run a bakery. You know, it's easy to quit, but I've just always been inspired by these people that said, "I don't quit."
I love it. So you finish up at University of Pennsylvania. University of Pittsburgh.
I'm not that smart.
Okay. And then I guess you get recruited to Wall Street and you start working for JP Morgan first.
Yes. Those were crazy days. So my internship was in 2006. So when you see those movies like The Big Short, that was real. And I still look back on it and it's, I don't know, what's that word? Surreal. Mm-hmm. How this class of 150 kids from all over the country, we're treated like we're rock stars. We're like 21-year-old idiots. And they're taking us out to all these fancy clubs and doing all this wining and dining us and trying to recruit us to accept full-time offers to come back. And then it was so crazy. 2007 comes around. We all come in. You know, those of us who decided to come back, we all come back. And that's when the market started to get shaky. And so I had all these colleagues, these classmates, that wanted to go into derivatives, right? The CMOs, the CMBS, financial engineering. And all these jobs just started to disappear. They just said, "We're sorry, that desk is shutting down that you were recruited to come back to, and we don't have a place for you." Thankfully for me, I just came in with this very simple job that I wanted. I just wanted to trade stocks. It was probably the joke job of the class, but it was definitely turned out to be the safest. And I did not know that that was going to even be a concern at all. But yeah, so I started trading stocks, consumer stocks in 2007 at JP Morgan, had some great mentors there and traders that I worked with. And that was a ride to be a Wall Street trader between 2007 and 2011. That was a ride.
For sure. But why did you feel like you didn't fit in?
So if I think I might still have it saved in a folder at home. I mean, I think this goes back to the same thing as high school. You're always kind of comparing yourself. Where do I fit in? What's my spot on the team? Am I valuable? Am I not? Where do I fit? They give you class ranks and everything, right? And so I get this 150 person class coming in at JP Morgan, and it's 98% Ivy League, Stanford, University of Chicago, Duke, Caltech, the list goes on. And then I am literally the only non-target school hire. I say, why am I here? You know, how did I get here? You know, I know I'm going to fight like hell to really make my way here and be successful. And I can tell you, no one worked more hours than me. I was in there at 3 a.m. and worked until 8 every night. I mean, I killed myself to say I deserve to be here and I'm going to show them I can be here. But yeah, I think it was just the school. Because everyone's one of the first questions everyone asked you, "Oh, what school are you from?" I'm like, how'd that guy get here, right? So again, I just had this interview and I just was very authentic with the hiring people, because I'm sure everyone comes in very prepared, has all the right answers. And I just gave them the authentic version. I think that might've been refreshing or something a little different. They said, we'll take a chance.
That's what you feel like the difference maker was.
I think so. And I look for that in my interviews too. Now I'm interviewing people. It's like some people come in, they have all the right answers. They can tell you exactly what you want to hear. But some people would say, hey, I'm not going to be perfect. I struggle with this, but you're going to get my all. And I have good emotional intelligence and can connect with people. And I feel so much more comfort around those hires. And it's led, I think, to having some really low turnover rates at our businesses. It's just finding true, authentic people that can connect with me as a manager and not feel like they have to overcompensate or seem too stiff. It's like, we're in the hospitality business. You have to be able to connect with people, talk to them. When the little kid comes in, you have to be able to, get down on one knee and talk to a little kid sometimes and make their day special. And I'm going to get that out of my authentic person more than I am with somebody that, just has all the right answers and can tell me what to do by the book.
So comparing resumes was one reason you didn't feel like you fit in. Did a lot of these, new hires, did they come from money?
I would imagine so. We never got into it too much, but, let's just say my clothes came from Marshalls and theirs did not. So I worked 4 jobs my senior year in college while I was taking 26 credits, and my mom said, David, if you want to live on campus at school, you got to pay your own way. So I was working for the university. I worked for a beer distributor with a drive-through. They called it the brew-through. Fridays and Saturday nights. I worked for a financial advisor. I'm forgetting offhand my other job. But yeah, everything I had that senior year, I had to grind out myself. When I moved to New York, I took a loan from my mom and paid her back to buy my first mattress and my first futon and all that stuff. So I don't know. It doesn't really matter where people came from. We are all, at the end of the day, we're all sitting there in the same spots. And actually half of those kids with those pedigrees didn't have a job after a month or two of a training program. So it didn't matter. But in my mind, I still had this chip on my shoulder, like I had something to prove.
And where does that chip come from? Does it come from, has it always been there since you were little?
I think so. You're sitting here looking at me. I came in 5'9". I was a fat kid in middle school. In middle school, 3.0 grades. I mean, I was your average kid to a T. And then in high school, I talk to this about with my wife sometimes about our own kids. I said, I don't know what happened in high school. I think as soon as they started ranking us on our grades, something competitive just clicked. When I was little, I did karate and I swam and I was pretty good. And I qualified for the Junior Olympics in swimming. And then I just stopped. But something clicked in high school and they started ranking us. And I thought, oh, now we're quantifying this? That's for some reason how I got my value. And then in college, I guess the same way. Grades mattered. Being on that track team mattered. My times mattered. And it's just always trying to improve and be better, very quantitative. So on my side, I think sometimes I fail to look at the qualitative stuff as much as I should because I've just always prioritized the numbers. I think that's being a sports fan too, I guess, growing up, loving mm-hmm. sports, collecting the cards, looking at the stats, the players. Numbers just always seem to stick out and matter the most. And I guess that probably what attracted me to statistics and economics and finance is the number side of it. And that drives me a lot.
Does that help you as you run your business, I assume?
Oh, absolutely. So, I still track every single day, the sales every day, and I compare it versus last year. And I take a lot of pride in that. I take a pride in our retention numbers. I take pride in our cost of goods sold numbers. I take tons of pride in our reviews and how those are coming in, how we quantify those. And so there is a huge element of numbers in there, but on the qualitative side, I think I see a lot of that come through the words in the reviews, but the numbers still matter too, right? Like, what are they, how, what's our average over the last week, over the last month at our different restaurants? How are we doing there? But I love the stories that come along when you get the reviews. That's actually the meat that matters to me, is those stories that come out. Because, you know, you get 100 five-star reviews in a row, but they say nothing other than that was great. But it's when someone takes that time and I can tell the manager broke out of the norm, just another customer coming in, or a customer, somebody breaks out of that cycle and looks at a customer as an individual and does such an inspiring job for them that they write something really quality and deep about that experience. Because in hospitality, that's like, that's the stuff that like makes me feel like we're making a difference in people's lives, is those stories. And sometimes I'm very grateful we get those deep, thoughtful reviews that come in that show that we still do that despite volumes being record highs every month, higher volume, higher volume, higher volume, higher sales, that we can still stop and make someone feel special.
I love that. So and how long did you work in Wall Street, and what was the tipping point to go, I'm going to go do a JD and an MBA combo?
I don't know if you ever feel this way. There's like certain periods of your life, right? Or there's certain, like, I don't know, like Taylor Swift Eras Tour. I don't know. We have these different, this is different like patches, right? So I worked on Wall Street 5-6 years, did a year at a private equity firm. And I just woke up on my birthday one year, I think it was 29. And I said, my window to go back to school is just, it's just shrinking. And of course I can go back to school when I'm 50. I'm sure I can, but it just might not make as much sense now or then as it does now. So I studied like 3 weeks for my GMAT, took that, and my wife and I took some, use it as an excuse to go out and visit some schools on the East Coast. But I felt like going back to school was the right thing. So 6 months after that, I enrolled at BYU and felt like that was the place to go. I had all these acceptances that had come in after my final round applications. And I'm like, I don't know where to go. And then I'm sitting in this room and this little kid turns around, gets a piece of paper and a pen out and just starts drawing BYU on the paper as I'm like staring at him. I'm like, oh, that's where I'm supposed to go. So that's why I went back to school. And how I got into law school is a different story, because I just applied for my MBA. We met the dean of admissions at a wedding reception and she's like, I like you. I think if you want to come to law school, you have good enough grades and a GMAT score that I can slide you in without taking the LSAT. So I did. So
that's awesome. So you basically did both at the same time.
I did both.
Yep. So it wasn't like you did MBA and then JD. You did in 3 years. You did both.
It actually took four.
Okay.
They do let you reduce some of the credit requirements, but it's still a 4-year deal for most people that do both.
And just because she asked you, or were you interested in law, or what did you think? Oh, well, I'm going to school anyway. I may as well.
Well, so I'm on Wall Street, right? And it's in the height of this Dodd-Frank legislation and all these. Every day I worked as a trader for the financial stocks from 09 to 11. And it's all about regulation, capital requirements, statutes. And I'm like, finance and law are so highly intertwined. So I was considering it anyway. I was considering it just because, you know, I figured if I'm going to do this for the next 30, 35 years, it's probably better to get a little bit of a deeper background. If it costs me a year, it costs me a year of work, but I think I'll be able to get more out of it. So I was looking at it, but I was like, I don't know where I have time to study for the LSAT. And it's not people, my law school class, these kids have like a 3.95 GPA. They're all brilliant and they take years to study for this LSAT. And I'm like, man, I don't know if I have time. It was truly, I think, heaven sent that I ran into this dean of admissions at a wedding reception, and that there was only this year, this rule that existed for 1 year from the American Bar Association that allowed them to waive an LSAT requirement if you had a good enough GPA and GMAT score. So thank you, Dean Mumford.
Shout out to Dean Mumford.
Yes.
All right. So you did an MBA and you did a JD and you've been on Wall Street doing finance. You didn't go back to Wall Street.
No.
Why?
BYU has some great alum. And so one day the CFO of Hanes, you know, Michael Jordan Hanes, mm-hmm. underwear socks, CFO comes back and I run into him and he's like, David, I have the perfect job for you. Come out to North Carolina, which I love the Carolinas. Growing up on the East Coast, I love the Carolinas. We would vacation there. So come out to North Carolina. You can help run our risk management for the company, you know, so our commodity risk management, you know, our balance sheet and work in our treasury department. And I thought, if the CFO of a Fortune 500 company is telling me to come out and work somewhere, I think I'm going to do it. So I went out there and 4 months later he retired, but I worked there for a couple years and set up, you know, how should the company think about buying cotton for all of its products globally? How should we think about, you know, debt ratios and what kind of capital structure we have. And so, I mean, this is a job that I was made for that job. The problem was I'm sitting in a corporate office in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, buying cotton futures. And I just didn't feel like it was dynamic enough. And it was cool. I get to go in and present to the CEO every month and talk to the CFO constantly. Like, that's a pretty cool job for a kid coming out of business school. But at the end of the day, I have that entrepreneurial itch that I'm sure all the other 27 people that have been on this podcast have had. And it wasn't going away. We had had at that point our first small business. It was a frozen yogurt store. It is the easiest small business to have. And we were owning it remotely. And I was like, we just got to go back. We have to go back. I have to do this small business thing. I just can't sit at a corporate desk all day. I must have undiagnosed ADHD or something, but I need to get back and work in small business again.
Let's talk about the frozen yogurt.
Yeah.
Was it a franchise that you owned or opened your own frozen yogurt place?
Yeah. So because my family had moved a couple times here in the state of Utah, instead of selling every house as we had moved, I just had held on to them. And I was at this point, we had like two or three rentals. I was looking for another one. And I'm on the MLS looking for another property. And I see this building put on there for a certain price. And I'm like, there's no way that building is selling for that. I call the broker and he says, yeah, you're right. He said, I'm a real estate agent. So I'm posting this business for sale in the MLS, hoping to get an extra lead that might help someone buy this business. And I said, well, I'm not super interested, but send me the numbers anyway. I'd never looked at a small business to buy before. And I looked through and I said, I think I can do this. It's a mile from my house. It's profitable. It has existing team in place. And it's not like a fine dining steakhouse. We're talking a frozen yogurt store where I'm walking in and I'm seeing a bunch of 16-year-old kids running it. I think I can figure it out. So at that time, I was a student. And we had some savings, but most of our money was tied up in real estate projects. I didn't know how I was going to buy it. So I get this question all the time from students or from people that are working in corporate worlds. Like, how do you buy a business? I tell them, I've done it every way. But the way we did it this time was I called up my mom and I said, Mom, there's this business I want to buy. And she's like, well, how much is it? I said, well, it's $300,000. She said, okay. I have IRA money that we can use. So she went and self-directed her IRA. She sold her stock in Amazon and Apple and all that stuff back in 2015. If you pull up the charts right now, you'll see my mom has given up a lot. And she helped me buy that first business on September 15th, 2015. And took a chance on her son, who's never owned a small business, said, that was her entire, she only had a slightly more than that. That was her entire life savings. And my mom went and liquidated the stock in those companies to invest in the stock of me. Several years later, we operated the business, paid her back in full, and have since just obviously grown it to the point now where that business was doing $400,000 a year in revenue. This year, we'll be doing almost 15. And, it's all thanks to a mom that believed in her son and said, this is my greater work, is to invest in you than to invest in anywhere else. So that lady is just didn't give up her parenting at age 18 or 20 or whatever. She views it as a lifelong commitment, and I just couldn't be more grateful.
That's amazing. Are you an only child?
Oh, I'm one of five.
One of five.
But definitely her favorite.
She, you must be. You must be, if she took a chance on you
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So she has this thing where she says she has her top three at all times. Said, am I always in the top three? She said, 95% of the time you are. So yeah. So I'm doing pretty good.
So you're at Haynes and you decide with your wife, and did you have children at this point too?
Yeah,
we had to uproot three, everyone from the Carolinas, come back to Utah.
We had just had our fourth kid.
Okay.
And so I'm sitting there, and again, I'm just feeling this itch, like, oh my gosh, I gotta get back out there. I look up, I'm looking at small business listings, and I don't know if you've looked at them before. It's not like the MLS for real estate. You can look out there on the MLS and probably see 98, 99% of all listings out there, right? Small business is not the same way. It's this hodgepodge of classified, some brokers. And to be perfectly honest, how I feel now is there's a lot of listing. I mean, people are willing to sell, but they don't know what to do. They don't know where to put it. They don't know who to call. They're basically, unlisted listings. I get a call. This guy, Sean, calls me. So a doctor sold me that frozen yogurt store. The guy had a second one that this other guy bought, right? And I'd always stayed in contact with him because we had the same vendors. We shared an employee, actually. So I always stayed in contact with Sean. He calls me one day. I'm sitting in North Carolina in July. He says, David, I got to sell my store. And I'm like, okay, what's going on? He said, I have been collecting the sales tax from these customers for the last 2 years. I've never paid it to the state. Well, they got wind of it. And I have all of these back due taxes to pay, penalties, interest, blah, blah, blah. He's like, I just need to sell and I need to sell quick. And my eyes just like, this is my chance. And I knew how well that store had, had performed. And so 6 weeks later, we bought it from him. And he even financed part of it for us. So when I say I bought businesses, a lot of different ways. I've used SBA, seller financing, an IRA to do that. I've done cash. We've done it all. But those unmarketed or unlisted listings, those are the ones that where you find all the meat. So if I had just not stayed in contact with him, then it probably wouldn't have come up. But it was really this blessing of having him in my network and talking to him that I became his first call. And that's how we were able to buy that and sell it for five times as much as a couple of years later, because he basically gave it away. He gave it away for less than what we made on it the first year.
So you was that the turning point to come back to Utah, was the second store?
That was it. The one we had out here, everyone knows the saying, when the cat's away, the mice will play. The store was failing. I felt this anxiety, and there were several months where I was actually funding some of the expenses from the store with my corporate paycheck. So I had this anxiety come back because, again, this is in my bones. This, I don't fail. This is not going to fail. This is not going to happen. And so when I had the sister store come up for sale that I knew performed super well and we were going to get a steal of a deal on, I said, that's enough. But it's also that same summer when the Lehigh Bakery came for sale. We lived in Lehigh for a season while I was in school, and I would take my boys there to get donuts every Wednesday morning. We'd go, we'd get some donuts, we'd sit down in the parking lot, we'd eat them and watch the guys doing CrossFit in the gym, in the little gym behind us. We'd be eating our donuts and they're like throwing around the cowbell, you know? So I actually have a picture. That's one of my favorite pictures I have of my little boys, is for one of those mornings. So it was during that summer of 2018 where we bought these two businesses that changed our lives. The one that we were to buy and then eventually sell for a big profit that we got such a deal on. And then kind of the other side of the coin, that one is the Lehigh Bakery, which is now just, we've owned it now for slightly over 5 years. That is just our long-term beloved brand that we're going to take. And we're not looking to flip it. We're not looking to sell it in a couple years. We're looking to have this thing for the next 30 years and make it into a long, tenured, beloved bakery name.
Would you buy square donuts when you went to the Lehigh Bakery?
Oh, yes, we'd buy them all.
But that's the one they're famous for.
That's correct? What they're famous for. I mean, yeah. So you have this at that point when we bought it, 49-year-old bakery in this hole-in-the-wall place. I don't know if you'd been to the
I've
old
been
one
there.
Before.
Yeah, the old one. Yeah.
Yes, and every day sells out by 10 o'clock. Every day, if you weren't there early, there were things that they had that just, if you weren't there at 7 o'clock, you weren't guaranteed that it was going to be there later on in the day. So as we were looking at that business, I had never even, I can't even make a Betty Crocker cupcake at this point. Like that's how, I have no bakery skills at all. Like literally my skill set at this point is I can pour pre-made frozen yogurt mix in the back of a Taylor machine. That's my skill set. So we're looking at this bakery. I have no experience, but what I do know is, from my life, is I can figure out things, right? Never really run before, but I could figure it out. I don't have this great finance knowledge, but I can figure it out. And so we buy it in December of 2018. I still don't know why that bank gave me that loan, but they did. And I just proceeded at that point to every day. At that point, it was 5 days a week, Tuesday through Saturday, 1 a.m., 5 days a week, 10, 12 hours a day, every day to learn this thing because all my eggs were in that basket. Everything was in that basket. But the blessing of buying an existing business, I'm not sure how many people you've talked to about entrepreneurship through acquisition, but one of the blessings is that you're walking into, I knew on day one, December 5th, 2018, there are going to be customers flooding through that door. And that was great. And thankfully we also had a seller that was understanding of my position, stayed with me for 6 months. Brent Tuckett stayed with me for 6 months to make sure that the handoff of the recipes and the processes that they had at the time, went well.
Did you use the funds from the sale of the other business to buy Lehigh Bakery, or did you buy them both at the same time?
We bought them around the same time. Okay. And so, I mean, at that time I was working a corporate job. We had a little bit of savings. We didn't have much. I had to borrow against everything we had. I borrowed against paid off cars. I borrowed money from a friend against our frozen yogurt machines at our first store. Like I borrowed money from everywhere. In some ways, I hope I can't get in trouble. I think it almost was borderline against the rules, but we got it done. So we pulled every resource we had. So all the eggs were in that basket and there was no option to fail. I mean, but thankfully, because of the strength and the reputation and why we bought the bakery in the first place, we were able to not just make the payments. We paid off the bakery in 3 years. I mean, we just hammered that debt away. We just didn't want that as a risk going forward.
You were all in.
All in, 100%.
Like literally,
yeah,
all in.
I mean, here I have all these classmates from law school, from my MBA. I mean, still friends from, Wall Street that are working there. I'm working at 1 a.m. in probably the crustiest bakery in the United States. I remember my first day walking in, there's buckets on the ground. I'm like, why are there buckets here? They're like, they're catching the rain or the melting snow as it comes through the ceiling. I'm like, what did I just buy? But I had this opportunity and I'm sure some other dads can relate to it, right? As much as it was a dirty job and people kind of look down on these dirty jobs, I think in some ways, I think that's why Mike Rowe has been so successful in what he's done. But we've just been able to, I was able to go in and say, working at this bakery is actually going to make our family monetarily 3 or 4 times as much money as it used to working these fancy jobs at Hanes or we made twice as much money that first year at that bakery than I did working on Wall Street. And I felt even, not just because of the money, it's not because of the money, but I felt so much more pride in it because I did it with my own hands, right? My little boy would come in and work the cash register. My wife would come in and make some bread on the hard, heavy days. The night before Thanksgiving, we're all in there for 12 hours making butterflake rolls and everything. So there's just so much more pride that came from that for me than pushing the buttons on the keyboard. So as much as we've enjoyed financial success personally and been able to give a lot of that back to our employees, man, it's just been so much more rewarding to drive this ship And if you've seen our new building now down there on Main Street, we just finished completion of a $3.5 million state-of-the-art bakery down there. We just take a lot of pride in that we're able to change the lives for our employees, for the customer experience, and deliver more in ways that the bakery's never had been able to before.
When did the new building open then?
I can tell you, it was the day I was at the Michigan-Ohio State football game. Was that 3 weeks ago, 3.5 weeks ago? Okay. I had bought tickets to the Michigan-Ohio State football game to take my son Calvin to. And because some piece of equipment got delayed, it was supposed to open on a Tuesday. It got pushed to Saturday. I missed the grand opening of it. But yeah, so I think it was like November 24th or something like that, somewhere around there. But we opened it recently. And it's just no super big grand opening. The mayor came. We cut a little piece of ribbon, but we just continued shouldering on. There's no need to make a super big deal out of it.
And that was how many years after you bought it?
Just under 5 years.
Amazing.
So everybody gets excited about doing step number 10, 11, 12, 30, 40, 50. The fact is, in my mind, it's very linear. You do step one. Step one was come in. I had no recipe book. Everything Brent did was touch, feel, didn't work for me without that experience, right? He did it for 50 years. He could touch and feel his way around. That's too stiff. Add more water. I said, Brent, I need to measure things out. So we built a recipe book, and then we took our operations to another level. There's a company here in Lehigh called Jolt. I don't know if you've seen that name around. Guy comes in one day, he's like, David, what's some of the problems you're having? And I said, boom, 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 all these operations. He's like, I can solve 95% of that for you. So we implemented these systems with these checklists, right? And it's helped our operations run so smooth. He's like, Chick-fil-A all across the country uses Jolt to help make their operations happen better. So we did that.
It's a company that comes in and helps you, or
they have a software. It's a checklist software. And so instead of how I had done up to that point, paper checklist. Write your initials next to the fact that you cleaned this or did that. Didn't happen with the regularity. I don't care who signed their names next to it. It didn't always happen, right? Whereas they come in and they're like, we have this on an iPad. If you say you want your mixing bowl clean, you can have them take a picture of it to show that it's done. More accountability, right? It name stamps it, time stamps it, pictures, counting, whatever it is. And so we still use that to this day across all of our businesses, all these things to help our operations run smooth, because I can't spin all these 50 plates at the same time unless I got some really good foundations for everything. So everything is, anytime something breaks in our business, we build another Jolt item to make sure it doesn't happen again. You do that every day across every business, 365 days a year, you just get some super smooth operations, and that's what we need. That's why we've been able to handle the volume of the bakery tripling in 5 years, is because we've been able to have this safety in operations. So yeah, it would be super exciting if the first thing I did at the bakery was build this brand new building. But it's been recipes, it's been operations, it's been the financial, let's take down the debt. We paid off the business and the real estate, right? Then you make the plans and you do that. And so, now it's to expanding. Now it's to a second and a third store next year, right? But now we have the foundation to build from. So I'm just like everybody else. I really can't wait till we get to store number 50, but you got to get your second store right. How do you make sure that quality consistency stays the same between the first and the second store? I don't want people saying to me, February of next year, David, that Saratoga store is a real disappointment. The product's totally different over there. That's just not going to fly with me. So, because the quality and the standard, it has to be the exact same. So now we're implementing more software solutions into there. Training videos of what is the exact standard of how you make this donut, with how you clean this, with how you maintain that. How do you clean this frying oil? How do you make this donut look consistent every day, every time? How do you do that? And so I'm learning. We've never had a second store we've made products like this. So how do we do it? How do we have that consistency? It's new for me. It's not new for people in this industry, but it's new for me.
And did you always have the vision that you were going to expand, or were you heads down, we're going to make this store work, and then it was very successful, and then you could look up and go, okay, now let's do a new building?
We knew we needed to improve the building. I made a promise to the employees on day one. I said, this building will not be here forever. We had no heat or air conditioning. People were getting injured in there all the time. And we were busting at the seams. So that building being improved was step one. But we would have customers come in all the time and asking, would you please open a store here? I've had people asking to franchise that bakery since the first months we owned it. And the first guy that came in, he's from Dallas. He's like, I really want to open a Lehigh bakery down in Dallas. I said, dude, there's nothing for you to franchise here. I don't even have a recipe book. And he didn't really understand that. So there has to be the structure in place that can support the weight. And there was nothing there. But, 8 months ago, I had someone who manages over $1 billion, not more than 5 miles from where we're sitting today. He came and he said, David, come to my office. He said, I want to take you nationwide like Crumbl. And it just, for some reason, it just wasn't a, first off, that's saying something, because that's been the most rapid and amazing expansion I've ever seen. But it wasn't a personality fit in terms of, being the right partner. But, we just have a different outlook on how we want to grow and expand, and it's not the same. Crumbl is more of a franchise model, and they lease their spaces, where I'm just more of in the camp of a Chick-fil-A, where I wouldn't say, let's keep them corporate owned so we can control the quality as best we can. We want to own our real estate. We like the financial benefits of it, as long as the long-term benefits of owning your own real estate. It's really hard to compete with someone that doesn't pay royalties and doesn't have a rent payment. We've going to store number two and number three has become one, because I saw that people were asking for it. But then if we built the structure, we can do it. We can duplicate it if we have the structure in place.
So you've said, we're in the donut business. Yes. But more importantly, we are in the people business. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I think that's hospitality across the board. If you work in a hotel, yes, you sell rooms by the night. That's how the revenue comes in. But Marriott or IHG or any of these places, the people come to them because of the. Not just the quality of the rooms, but it's the quality of the service they provide. So for us, there's two sides of the people equation. There's the employee side, and then there's the customer side. So, one of the conversations we're having right now inside us as we're looking again with metrics and how to be better is, if we're expecting 60 people to come in or 60 groups to come through the front door in an hour at the bakery on a Friday morning, how many people should we have to serve them so we don't have this interaction? What else? This is your total and move on, right? What level, how long should we expect our team to spend with a group to make them not feel rushed, to make them feel seen, to spend the time to explain the donut to them or to talk to them about the event they're ordering a cake for, doing all of that, right? So on that side of it, we're trying to make sure that people interaction with the customer side to make them feel special. I think that's been what's made the bakery successful is having that tone. And there's a little time when I broke my ankle and all I could do at that point was be on my little knee scooter and hand out donut holes. And people said, man, you're going to be the best Walmart greeter that exists when you retire, And so that's the tone I try to set, is that we see the customer. I never, ever want to be the place that just shoves people through like they're cattle. So that's the one side. When little kids come in, if they don't get a donut hole and we don't look them in the eye and give it to them, make them feel special, like this is like the coolest day, you get to come get a donut and then they're giving me an extra one for free. Those kids are our future customers, right? Make them feel special. Make them feel like, yes, you came here and you won. The other side of it's the employees, and this is probably my favorite part of the business in terms of the strategy or the important thing. We have the hardest jobs to hire for in this entire town, maybe even in the state. We're talking in a state here with unemployment, what, below 3%? How do I get people to come in to work at that point at a 100-year-old building with no heater or air conditioning, to come in at 1 a.m, fry donuts, get covered in oil and flour? How do I get those people? Who are those people? Who wants that job? And so we found some pockets of people that like that, right? Like, my favorite contingent at our Lehigh Bakery is a stay-at-home mom. But she wants to get out of the house, come out, make a little bit of money for her family before her kids wake up or before her husband leaves in the morning. They come in, they make donuts, they fry, they decorate, and then they go home. We found these little pockets of people that really work and work well. They're so responsible. And I've been able to have amazing retention with them across the board. I think in 2021 or 2020, I lost one person out of 40 at our bakery. They like working with each other. I think for me going forward is we've kind of, you know, we're always trying to find ways to find the best people. But, you know, we've added paid healthcare for our people. We've added 401k stuff. But then starting next month, we're going to be doing something even more radical, which is not very common in our industry, is we're going to be making our bakery employee owned. Because if I'm thinking about what's better than me being there on my knee scooter handing out donut holes and making sure every customer feels seen, is if I had 10 people at our bakery every day giving that same care to every product, every icing, every donut, making sure it looks perfect, every customer interaction. If we can have 10 owners in that building, I just can't think of a better way to serve people with hospitality than if the owner does it in 10 different ways every time they're there. As we expand, I think this is also going to be a helper for us, you know, finding and attracting the best talent in the industry. You know, if you set yourself apart in how you compensate and treat your employees within your industry, you're going to attract the best, no matter what it is, right? Tech, financial services, or a little hometown bakery. If you can do that and do that the best in your industry, you're going to have the best people. And everything I've seen, if you have the best people, you win every time. And so that's my outlook for us, is find and attract the best. And with that kind of momentum, with owning our real estate, with, you know, 54 years of brand recognition, with, you know, quality lines, you know, donuts, cookies, cakes, I just try to build this boat of safety and protection. And every day we're just adding more financial strength, people, you know, adding, working on our recipes. Everything we do every day is to make us a stronger company. And that's why sales are up 35% this year in a, you know, a tough food environment.
And so what you've done is super unique in the food industry. It's unheard of. If someone working at a bakery that's not a, I don't know, like a Smith's or Kroger, right? Two or three store bakery. It's very rare that someone would have health insurance or 401k or these kinds of things, right?
Oh, I think 401ks might be more common. That really doesn't cost the employer that much. But the healthcare side, I had an employee, that one person that left in 2020 said, "Why are you leaving?" She was really great. She was an amazing cake decorator. She said, "David, I need healthcare." And my flag just went up. And I said, I can't be losing great people because I don't want to have that expense. So we added it the next year. We have a healthcare stipend for all of our people. Most of it covers their entire cost of their healthcare. And then what recently just came up last week, we lost one of the moms at our bakery. This actually came up last week. One of my favorite employees, there, she said, "David, I love the bakery, but the hours are killing me." So for a while, because the volume has risen so much, the answer was just start a little bit earlier, start a little bit earlier, start a little bit earlier. And that's just, it's caused a little bit of employee burnout. Right. And so a couple of days ago, I went in to my general manager, my head baker there. And I said, "We need to redesign this process to make it more sustainable for our employees. Every 6 months, I don't want to burn through another amazing person we fought so hard to find, because they are, as she said, turned into a zombie mom." I said, "I can't have that for her personally or for this business." So we're in the process of saying, okay, what do we need to do to redesign our processes to make us a little bit more employee friendly? So just at anywhere else, anybody's working, process improvement and it's the same thing for us. Even after 5 years, there are still major things that we can do to be better.
So Square Donuts, and this year you were on track to sell a million.
About a million.
It's your number one seller, right?
Yes.
It accounts for a third of your revenues or something like that. The Square Donuts of Lehigh.
Yep.
They're famous for. Have you crossed that number yet?
I have to check. We're getting really close. A school ordered 3,000 today. That always helps.
So you might be close. You still have, 11 days left?
Yeah. So. It's wild to me. Sometimes I just stand there and I just look from the back, you know, through that little, the black swinging door with a little window. And I said, where do all these people come from? And then I go out there and I talk to them. Oh, I'm driving every time I drive from Boise down to see our family down in Tucson or whatever. Every time we always get off the exit here in Lehigh and come in. I'm like, it's amazing sometimes where these people actually come from when you ask them. But I mean, that's, again, one of the blessings of buying a 50-year-old business is you've built these connections from everywhere. Hey, every time my grandkids come in from Michigan, we always bring them in every time. It's become tradition for so many people. And that's one thing I really love about this business is, I used to work on Wall Street. People would pick it outside of our building, you know, Occupy Wall Street. No one gets mad at me now. No one gets mad at the donut guy. It's a pretty good life. And most problems can be fixed with a couple more donuts. So it's not a bad life.
People are happy to come in there. I mean, you have customers that are smiling as they come in there.
Yes.
Right? Because they know they're going to get something amazing.
Yep. My favorite thing to do at the bakery is to give tours, whether it was the old building or the new one. Yesterday I had some, I think a 10, 11-year-old girls from a local church group came by and we just took them around for an hour. And those girls, you just would have thought that they were at like Disneyland. They just loved it. All my stories about each piece of equipment and stuff that, you know, for me at this point, it's not as exciting anymore, but these girls love it. Or my real favorite group is when I get like the 3 and 4-year-old kids from a preschool. They come in with like their little chef hats on and their little aprons. I love that. That's what makes it fun. I have such a dynamic life at this point. You know, we're hopping between the bakery to Maggleby's. We have a little pizza store we run. And I definitely have my meetings. We're talking about, you know, where to order from this product the best. And there's the business side of it. There's the people side. I have, you know, collect some money on our catering stuff. That stuff's all out there. But when I see in my calendar pops up, I have a tour to do at the bakery with a bunch of kids. That's my favorite thing on the whole calendar. I think that for me goes back to, I told you, I was a big sports fan growing up. Jerry Rice was my favorite football player. And I was in like 5th grade, the school book fair. There was this book, addresses for all of your favorite athletes. You know, this Scholastic book fair. It was like Roberto Alomar. I mean, all the way. I mean, there must have been 1,000 people in there. I probably sent out 200 letters with a sports card in there to 200 people. One person responded. Jerry Rice responded. His assistant, you know, probably a signed photo. And I always have that photo. I always remember it because, again, it made me feel the day that came in the mail. I checked the mail every day for 2 months, hoping somebody would write back. I don't care. Give me, you know, Omar Vizquel, you know, from the Indians, whoever it is. I just want one back to show that this book worked. I got it back from Jerry Rice. And I still have that picture and it's signed. And I kept the letter and the sports card and all that stuff. And it just, that to me stuck out as when you have your little fan group, even if they're a bunch of 3-year-old kids, they just literally just want a donut. Make them feel seen. That's how you build fans for life. So I tell my people at the front counter every day, make a fan for life. Walk them to their car with their donuts. Ask them what it's for. You know, it's for their daughter's wedding. It's for, you know, they hit a goal at in their kindergarten class and they're excited to talk about it. But if you do that with one person every day, that's how they built this 54-year-old bakery that's still growing 30%+ a year, is because we do those little things and see everybody individually.
I love that. So you're getting that photo from Jerry Rice. He will never not be your favorite football player ever the rest of your life now.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? No one's going to take his place because no. you have that.
Yeah. And people told me once, they said, you know, at a restaurant, a lot of times they're coming in to celebrate or to medicate. Like, medicate. They're having a hard time, right? We have a little cookie store we help with, and there's so many times a woman will pull up to get her drink and she's just crying, right? And I've told my people, it costs $3 or $4 to give that lady something for free and to help turn her day around. Just do it. It's my money. It's not yours. Just give it to her. And so if we can hit in those moments when it matters most to people, you can really help. That's like in that Inside Out movie. That's a core memory, right? That's like a core memory of like whenever Cal and I ran on the field at the Michigan-Ohio State game a few weeks ago, right? I mean, it's getting that letter in the mail. It's, you know, taking that time to take that kid on a tour. That kid came in a month ago crying with his mom. And I just saw him and I'm like, I don't know, just go ask. Hey, would he like a tour of the bakery? We took him around for 20 minutes. That kid left the happiest kid ever. We sent him home with a little cake too. You don't think that kid's going to bring his kid in 20 years and tell that story? That's the stuff we do to try to make a difference.
I love these stories. So how did you become a Michigan fan?
I'm not. I just didn't want to get beat up. So there, you know, with the game this year, you know, the stakes were so high because next year the playoff goes to 12 teams. This year it's four. It's the last year it's at four. So you had number two versus number three, and I said, Cal, we're going to go. So we went out to Michigan, and it was quasi-work trip. There's a company I really respect out there called Zingerman's. They have this little community of businesses where they have a roadhouse and a bakehouse and a deli, and they kind of cross-pollinate. They make the bread at the bakehouse, and it serves the restaurants and the deli, and they kind of have this really cool company. It was named by Inc. as the coolest company in America a couple decades ago. And so I viewed it as this chance to go out to a cool football game with such high importance. But then secondly, to go out and see Zingerman's and just try the food. What was amazing when I was out there in Michigan, I took my 9-year-old Cal. So we go to the deli. You have to wait 2 hours for your sandwich. I mean, just got like a Reuben. It took him 2 hours, but it's okay. It was worth it. It was more just the experience of being like, man, look at this business. It's thriving. Even after all these decades of being open, we go to the Roadhouse at night, which is like, you know, burgers and barbecue and stuff. I'm sitting there with Cal and we're getting excited about the game tomorrow. And I see the founder in there walking around to the tables, delivering dessert. This guy has a $100 million business. I'm sure it's at least $100 million. Coolest company in America. It's a Friday night. You would think that he would be anywhere else. He's walking around pouring water in people's glasses at their tables. I mean, the hallmark of humility, he's doing a $12 an hour job and he's doing it with a smile on his face. So I recognized him because I'd seen pictures of him before and I just grabbed them. I said, actually, I had Cal grab him. I said, Cal, can you just make sure you ask him what his name is? And I told him, what you've done here with Zingerman's, I read about in a book called Small Giants. I said, what you did has helped inspire me to get started. You know, we have a bakery, we have Magleby's, you know, we have a pizzeria, and some of them, the way that we make the Magleby's cake at Lehigh Bakery just because we have such better ovens and capacity to do it, right? So I told him, like, you've inspired me to do what I do. And they do some things different than us in terms of their employees and their model. They have a partnership model where he has a managing partner at each store, and that's how he does it. But he gave me his personal business card, and he said, anytime you ever need anything, just contact me. Just here's my email. You just call whatever you need. And so I just have come to love these authentic people that you come across, because there's just so much today of wanting to appear to be the expert and exclusive and everything. And then there's the people that walk around and pour your water for you. And I'm sure to everybody else in that restaurant, they didn't know who he was, but he didn't need that. He didn't need everyone to know that he has achieved so much. He was just happy to serve.
Have you called him or emailed him? Or
I emailed him. Yeah. So part of next year, what I want to do is there's within our industry, there's people that are known to be the best for certain things, right? So, you know, what they do really well is how they work all their businesses, their various interests together, right? You know, McDonald's and Chick-fil-A have really great real estate strategies, right? And so there's some really interesting companies out of California, like one called Cali Barbecue. He treats his restaurant like it's a media company. So much media put out about how they do it, what they do. I mean, not just the videos of them smoking the ribs or anything like that, just everything they do is to make their restaurant like a media company. So there's all these different people that do different aspects of, if you were to go up and down an income statement, say Chick-fil-A is great here on the service side and marketing, these people are great and real estate on this side. And so part of what I want to do next year is go around and find some of these people and go out and visit their restaurant or their concepts for 3 to 5 days and just learn from them. Because I'm smart. I've been to a lot of school. I'm knee deep in all the stuff we do. But there are some people that are way smarter and way further down the line than me. And I'm going to look to learn from them.
That sounds like an awesome 2024 goal.
Yeah. I mean, San Diego. I mean, we'll go across the country finding these places. So a little bit of a Guy Fieri Diners, Drive-Ins and Dives, like kind of thing, just not focused on the food so much, more on how do you run your business and do it really well? And you're excellent at this. So let me learn from you.
Are you going to do any content clips or blogs and stuff as you go?
Yeah.
Let us all in on kind of what you're learning.
Yeah. So I hired a marketing person to help us this year and told her that we'd probably be doing some traveling to create some content, but also just to document it for us. If I could put it into some kind of written format as well to share it, that would be good too.
Awesome. I look forward to hearing more about that. So we're running out of time here, David. I do have a lightning round of questions and just a couple more to end with, but what is your favorite candy bar?
Twix.
Favorite music artist?
Oh, come on. Wee Banjo 3. I like bluegrass. That's weird. You don't get that too often out here in Utah, but I love bluegrass.
Interesting choice. I'm going to look them up. Favorite cereal?
Favorite cereal. I don't drink. Growing up, it was Frosted Mini Wheats, and I'd sneak some Oreos on the bottom just to, yeah, that's what I would do.
I've never heard of that combination, but it sounds amazing.
It hit them from mom, so they let them get soggy on the bottom and finish with that at the end, yeah.
Nice. Mac or PC?
Oh, Mac.
Google or Microsoft?
Google.
Dogs or cats?
Dogs.
You hesitated.
I had a cat growing up, and we have dogs now, and the dogs are winning me over.
Okay. Phantom or Les Mis?
Les Mis, for sure.
So one of the questions I had, because we didn't get time to get further down the journey, because you were... You went in and were hands-on at Lehigh Bakery. You eventually expanded and bought some other restaurants. You mentioned Maggleby's. Were you hands-on at each of these as you bought them, or was it mostly Lehigh Bakery where you were up at 1 a.m.?
The hard part at this point is, at this point, we have 300-plus employees, and, you know, it's gotten bigger. I love doing the hands-on stuff. There's no better way to learn how to run a business better than do by getting in there and seeing it yourself, right? Like, so I get calls from people, I want to buy this and just, it's a franchise and I'll just hire people to run it. You're going to have a super inefficient business. If you don't know what to look for, or how to hire it, or what you're training for, or, it's just not going to run well. Maggleby's we bought in April this year. I was there busting tables today for the Wednesday buffet because that's the only skill I have there. I don't know how to make the steaks. I've never catered an event. So, you know, we bought it because of the strength of the name. It was a good financial purpose. It had some benefits to the bakery of bringing this legacy cake that everybody loves, right? So there was lots of benefits to it, but I wish I had the time, and with 5 kids and all these other businesses and the, you know, construction projects, which is my favorite thing to do besides the tours, you know, I can't give 30 hours a week to go into to work on the line. I have no, it's not because I'm prideful about it. I don't want to be like a line cook. It's just that I don't have the time for it. So as we expand going forward, you know, I'll try to do the best I can to understand the on the ground operations, but unfortunately I just don't have time to do it in the depth that I used to.
What's the best piece of business advice you've ever been given?
In business school, so I went back with 7 years of experience to business school, and whereas a lot of my classmates were 2 years at a job, and they didn't work on Wall Street. So in some ways, I went back, and there was a lot of stuff that was, you know, not as much for me. But there was one class in law school, one class in MBA school that stay with me. In MBA, I remember a class we were talking about debt. I have my CFA charter. I can do income statements, balance sheets, around corners, everybody else in that class. But I just remember this class, he framed it in a new way as we were talking about debt. And he just kept talking about, we were going through this case. And it came down to this thing of the way we make decisions, we have debt on the balance sheet and the payment to make is different than if you didn't. And so while we do take on some leverage to buy a company, I find so much more freedom when we don't have debt on there. I'm able to be more generous with my employees. I'm able to give stuff away to make customer happier without worrying, oh my gosh, it's going to stress the financials. You know, so we're able to be so much more generous and make so much better long-term decisions without debt. So for us, getting rid of debt quickly and strengthening that financial moat is always good. And then the law school side, it was the first day of law school at BYU, and this isn't necessarily business advice per se, but the BYU law school is named after a guy named J. Reuben Clark, and he was in the first presidency of the LDS Church, and he gave this talk once about those in the last wagon. And the story he's trying to tell is these pioneers were coming across the United States. There were the people in the last wagon. These usually were your people that just did not have much means. They were the slowest. They were sick. They were struggling. And he just says, remember those people in the last wagon. And in our industry, I feel like oftentimes we get some of those people right. They don't have all the resources. This is the job that they've just, because the way life happened to them, this wasn't just a stopping point for them on a career path. This has become their career. And just like my mom, who didn't have much growing up, looking at these people as valuable individuals, regardless of what their job title is and what their other opportunities are in life. And so even though it was just a talk about these, don't forget the people, the little people, don't forget those people in the last wagon. Those are the people that have made Lehigh Bakery great. Those moms, those donut fryers that are getting off of, I have a guy right now who just, for second day I met him, I said, oh, where are you going after? So I had another job, you know, I'm homeless right now. And I was just shocked. And it's been such a blessing to have him with us. And we've been able to make a difference in his life currently, and he's on his way back. You know, my manager's telling me they're buying their first house. I mean, these people that never had opportunities to give them to them, and that loyalty that they're able to give back to you. That's why my girl Caitlin worked for, not because I asked her to, she worked 30 straight hours making donuts around Halloween, 14,000 donuts. And it's, I think it's because she feels seen. And so again, we're in the people business. So we take care of them and they take care of the business. And I think a lot of stuff we learn in school or on Wall Street or any of the stuff that really overcomplicates, at the end of the day, you treat your people well, they going to go above and beyond for you.
I just love hearing these stories of how you're helping people. So I really want to thank you for being here tonight. I have one last question. What is a book that you recommend the most to people?
I mentioned Small Giants earlier. It's a great book that talks about small businesses that really want to be great, just not necessarily huge, but be great. That's a great book. And then it's a classic. It's like an OG book. I'm sure you've read The E-Myth. I love that book. Just talking about, you know, you might love being a technician, but running a business is something a little bit different. And how do we do that? Maybe a little bit more of a recent book. Dan Martell wrote a book called Buy Back Your Time. It's a book just about how, as an entrepreneur, how you should be thinking about what you do to free up your time to do certain tasks that you like to do. And so not only in there do you talk about his process of how he buys back his own time by hiring other people to do things that he doesn't like to do, he also just talked about being an entrepreneur and how why some of us are built the way we are. In some ways, an addiction to chaos. You made a comment earlier. I was like, I think that connected with me there. There's this element of chaos that sometimes as entrepreneurs just love the art of problem solving. And so it helped me understand more about me being an entrepreneur, maybe why I am wired the way I am wired. So Buy Back Your Time is another good one.
Thank you, David. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to be here. I'm so glad that Ian Bowles, episode number 18, connected us. What you are doing is so unique in the restaurant and food industry. And I know that you will have incredible success since you are designing and building values-based businesses. I hope that the way that you're treating employees as a business owner will inspire other business owners to implement similar incentives to create sustainable cultures and jobs. And I wish you massive success in the years to come.
Thank you. And I guess I would just close with thank you for having me. And that success words is a cool one, but I think it's for me, especially in the last year, it's been turning to be more significant, right? And impacting these employees' lives and impacting the lives of the customers. Cause that's, as like Kenny Chesney said, that's the good stuff.